Okay. So now, with the introduction that we gave last time, we're going to start the piece of Talmud that deals with the specifically with the seven laws of Noah. All right. Now, let's just first start the Talmud itself and raise the questions which occur to us naturally, and then I'll discuss with you some of the general principles and particular concepts involved. Okay. Now we're starting on 56A at the bottom in the Babylonian edition. In the Aramaic, it is two lines from the bottom. In English, I imagine it will be a little more, because English is a wordy language. So it should say the rabbis have stated, am I right? The rabbis have stated seven laws were commanded to the sons of Noah. If you have that part of the Tractate of Sanhedrin, 56a on the bottom, okay? All right, now let's just first read a little bit of the Talmud, and then we'll decipher it. All right, seven laws were commanded to the sons of Noah. And then it tells you the seven, all right? First one is that it mentions is the law of setting up courts of law. The second one it mentions is blasphemy, okay? The third one is idolatry. The fourth is the prohibition against sexual encounters. And the fifth is the prohibition against murder. The sixth is prohibition against theft. And the seventh is the prohibition against consuming, eating the limb of an animal that was taken from that animal during its lifetime. Okay, that statement so far doesn't pose any problem. But now we continue, and the Talmud states, Rabbi Hananya, the son of Gamliel, says, also with regard to blood of the living. Now this means that there's another prohibition, that a Ben Noach is not permitted to drink the blood that was taken from an animal during its lifetime. Okay, this is not the same thing as a prohibition of drinking blood, because if the animal died and then the blood was taken from it, then there would not in essence be any violation. Okay, the violation is blood that is taken from the animal during its lifetime, which means while the animal's alive, if you would go and you would take a pint of blood out of the animal, you would be prohibited to drink, to consume that blood. Okay. Let's go a little further. Now, Rabbi Hidke says that there's a prohibition for the Ben Noah even on castration. That means to destroy the procreative organs of any animal. Okay, that also is a prohibition. Then we have Rabbi Simon says there is even a prohibition on magic and sorcery. All right. And then we have Rabbi Josi says, he comments, that whatever is stated in the chapter on magic and sorcery, every Ben Noah is also enjoined to refrain from. Okay? All right, let's just stop here for a moment. What we have at present, without going any further, is the question which must be in the minds of all of those listening. And that is, first we start off with seven, then we add eight, the one with regard to the blood, and then we add with regard to the destruction of the organs of the animal that have to do with procreation. Then we have the prohibition on sorcery. Well, I mean, we're adding already 10, and then we even have another one later where it says that a Ben Noah is not permitted to crossbreed animals. okay, or to crossbreed trees. Okay, so it comes that we start off with 7, but then we wind up with 10 or 11. Now, how does this work? Someone that takes a look at the Talmud says, this is very puzzling. This doesn't seem to be very organized work. Numerically, they say 7, and then we wind up with 11. Okay, how do we approach this type of a question? What do we do with this type of question in Talmud? And the answer is that, you see, whenever you have an argument, a debate between the Talmudic scholars, and this is of fundamental importance, what it means is that there is a nucleus that was received from Sinai. The 7 laws of Noah were received from Sinai. Now, what happened was that throughout the generations, so some things were lost. Some facts were lost. And wherever facts were lost, the halacha does not come to a standstill, because then the Torah would never be workable today as it was in the days of Moses. So God, in his infinite wisdom, gave man a method to function, a way of operating and working, even if he should lose part of the system. Now, the way that works is simply that a person who is a very great scholar has the right and the ability to formulate theories. And according to his formulation, according to his theoretical understanding, he has a right to answer questions that arise. Now, there really is no difference between a question, let's say, for instance, we have modern-day technologies. With the modern-day technologies, halacha is confronted with new problems that it never had before. How do we work with them? Well, what do we do? Well, the answer is that this is not a new thing. It has already been given at Sinai. When God gave the Torah at Sinai, he didn't give a system that's going to come to a dead halt if certain things are forgotten, or that's going to come to a dead halt if new things are discovered and invented, because God knew that this would happen. So what God did in the Torah is he gave the people of the Torah, he gave man a way of working out these problems. And the way that it's worked out is very simple. It's the same way that a person works, studies physics or mathematics or any area of knowledge. And that is, if a person studies an area of knowledge, he must of necessity have what we call theories. Now, once a person has a theory always has certain results, whether it's a theory in math or whether it's a theory in science or whether it's a theory in halacha. Now, when you have a theory, so then according to theory A, then we should do X. According to theory B, we should do Y. So the way that the system of Torah works is that there is the theoretical part of Torah. In the theoretical part of Torah, a scholar has a right. Not every individual has a right to do this. I mean, a person who's an ignoramus, his theories are worthless. Just like a person who's an ignoramus in medicine, his theories are worthless in medicine and physics or any science. In order for your theory to have any value, you have to be a scholar in the field. And the same thing is true of Torah. Unfortunately, in Torah, everybody considers themselves a scholar, but such is not the case. So the method, getting back to the point I'm making, the method of analysis and the method of the continuity of Torah is based upon this most important principle, namely that the Torah is a theoretical work. So therefore, when a person studies all the facts that are available to him in Torah, if he knows all those facts, and if he has a great mind and he's a good theoretician, he has a right to set up theories and function and work according to his theories. That's why you have so many arguments in the Talmud. When you see an argument in the Talmud, what it means is simply that a piece of information has been lost, okay? And because of that, there is room for speculation and theory. I don't like to use the word speculation, because speculation sounds like just idle, speculative sounds like anything that comes to a person's mind. But the theories in the Talmud are of a certain type, and they have a specific form to them. But The point is, again, the main point is that when we find that a piece of information is missing, so then we have the scholars come and come along, and they give their theories. Now, this is true today. It's been true in the time of the Talmud. It's true throughout, from the time of Moses, when Moses debated with Aaron of eating, whether he did a certain sacrifice, or whether the daughters of Tzelophchad raised the question to Moses, and they debated their point with him. Debate and theory has been part of the Torah system from the day of its inception. So it's nothing new. And it's really the beauty of Torah. And as I've said many times, those of you who have read Psalms know how King David speaks about the great beauty of Torah. He's speaking about the theoretical aspect of Torah. Okay, so getting back to this point, what we have to do when we come to a piece of Talmud such as this, we raise the question. Question is, we said there's seven, but now we find there are many more than seven. What do we do with this? So what we have to do, first of all, is to ask another question. Did the scholars of the Talmud, who you have to remember that the information that the Talmud had was received from generation to generation, going all the way back to the giving of the Torah at Sinai. So it's a long time. Now what we have to try to do whenever we see an argument, what we have to try to do is to find out what does everyone agree about and what do they argue on. Now, you'll notice in the Talmud, there isn't just wild argumentation. For instance, there's no one here that says, there's no such thing as the seven laws of Noah. No position like that in the Talmud. Because this, we know that there are laws for the entire humanity. So this piece of information, the reason why nobody argues about that is because that piece of information was known by all. That was carried down accurately. What we have to ask in this case is, does everybody agree that there are seven laws? Or maybe this itself is a debatable point. Maybe some held there were seven, others held there were 11. Okay? In order to, at this point, what we have to find out is, and in every argument, what we have to discover is, what are they not arguing about, and what is the common point that everybody agrees on? Then, once we discover that, then we can discover what the argumentation is about. Okay? Is that clear? Is that logical? The way you study a piece of Talmud is when you see an argument, what you have to do is, first of all, find out what everybody agrees upon. Then, if you know that, then you can understand unravel what the theoretics are involved. Okay. So our question here is simply, was it carried down from Sinai to the scholars of the Talmud? Did they have this information that there were only seven laws, or is that itself a debatable point? Okay. So last time we studied together, I suggested that you read through the Talmud that deals with this area, and I said read through about pages. Now make reference to the information that's found further in this on this page. Okay. Now,
Rabbi.
Yes.
I think maybe something that we should look at in the beginning. You talked about the sages and the oral tradition coming down to the Second Temple period. What is the known sources of the seven laws of Noah?
The earliest known sources, all the sources that we have state that the seven laws of Noah were given at Sinai. Not a single scholar throughout the generations ever argued that point. In every generation, there were those that were in charge of keeping the corpus of the oral law. Moses gave it over to Joshua to the elders, etc.
Okay.
And there is no, the point I'm trying to make is that there is no doubt that this piece of information, that the seven laws of Noah were given at Sinai, no one argues with that point. So there is no, so it is quite clear that this point was carried down without any question from Sinai.
Okay, the point that I would make is that obviously, this was in existence prior to Sinai.
Oh, yes, that's true also.
So what is the, are there any ancient sources other than the oral tradition that dates it back? You know, we know that Some have said that Adam kept five of the Sheva Mitzvot.
We're going to get to that.
Okay, all right. And so this, I think this is the foundation. So, all right, if you're going to get there, I'll just drop out then.
Okay, because we're going to get the Talmud. We'll discuss that later.
Okay, all right, that's fine.
In other words, everybody's in agreement that it goes back to Noah. But if you go back to Adam, we'll see that that is not,
right.
That we don't have information about. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So the important thing to remember when studying Talmud is many people, you know, are people who are looking for a certain kind of religious security are always disappointed in Talmud because they see arguments and they want to know that what they're doing, this is exactly what God wants me to do. Well, in our religion, we don't say that. We don't say this is exactly what God wants us to do. We say God wants you to use your intelligence, your mind, and understanding, and do that. That's what you're supposed to do. Okay? In that respect, our religion differs from any other religion. And that's why you have all the arguments. So the arguments, which give certain people insecurities, really should give a person the greatest security. Why? Because you see that the debates of the scholars are never about the most basic issues. Now, why don't they argue that? Because it's obvious that they had carried down without any question that information. They're only going to argue where the information is lacking. So you could tell from an argument what information they had for certain and what information they didn't have, and then they go into theoretics. But that is the way the Torah works. Without theoretics, you would have no Torah. Because you understand very well, as soon as a piece of information is lost, that would mean it's lost forever. So that's why Torah could not survive without theoretics. But besides that, without theoretics, you wouldn't have any beauty of Torah. That's the whole beauty of Torah is theoretics. So it's important to realize, and I think this is one of the criticisms that people always make against Talmud. They say, well, the rabbis always argue. That's true, but look at what they argue. They will argue only certain points. Nobody, for instance, argues that you slaughter an animal by stabbing it in the belly. Nobody says that. Why don't they argue that? They argue every other point. And the reason is because that was carried from Sinai, that there is no doubt about that piece of information, that the slaughtering must be done on the underside of the neck. So there's no question about that. So the argumentation, rather than throwing a person into insecurity, really proves the point that the arguments of the Talmud are restricted to certain areas. So they're restricted to a certain radius, which shows that they had certain definite information which no one would argue about, which is proof of the Mesorah, of the what we call in English, I hate to use the word tradition, because tradition doesn't really mean intellectual knowledge. Tradition means something which is based on the fact that people just did things. I don't like to use that word. But it gives evidence to the fact that there was information that was carefully carried down from Sinai. Okay, so getting to the text of the Talmud, the question that we have to raise here is, was the information from Sinai intact in the time of the Talmud, in the time of the people that are discussing these laws over here, in their time, was there information to the effect that there were seven laws or not? Okay. Now, for that, let's make recourse to another piece of Talmud, which is found on 56b. All right. So the Talmud states as follows. Talmud states that there was a Tana, which means a scholar of the Mishnaic period, and he said that you take out out of the seven, remove two, and he put two other ones in. Which were the two that he removed? He removed, one of them that he removed was the law of the courts. He says that's not part of the seven. And the second one he removed was blasphemy. And instead, he inserted two other ones. One was the castration of animals. All right, and the second one is the crossbreeding. Okay, so this person, he took out two and he inserted two other ones. And the Talmud states that the Bei Menashe states seven mitzvahs were commanded to the children of Noah, and he gives his list. And instead of having the one about the courts, the legal system, the establishing of the legal system, he takes that out, and he also takes out the one about blasphemy, and he inserts instead the one about the castrating the animals and the crossbreeding. Okay, okay. Now, what do we see from that Talmudic, from that little piece of Talmud? We see that there was carried down from Sinai a numerical value of 7. Because here we see that this individual who disagreed with the rest of the scholars, he said, take out these two and insert other two instead. Now, why does he do that? In order to keep the number 7 constant. So we see that from the piece of Talmud following later, which we're not going to analyze right now as to the theory behind that. So we'll get to that a little later. But by the way, that happens to be a very practical issue. According to, if we maintain that there is a prohibition against destroying the procreative organs of an animal, then a person is not permitted to fix his dog or his cat. A non-Jew would not be permitted to do that as well. Ben Noach would not be permitted as well. And we'll see later that there are people that maintain that the prohibition is, in fact, existing today. But I don't want to right now get into the final practical halacha. All right, that's we will, but let's first get into the Talmudics first, and then we'll have a better understanding. So getting back to this point, we see from the way Talmud explains later that there was an opinion that took out two and inserted two others. You see from that type of a formulation that why did he take out two and insert two others? The reason is he's trying to keep the number 7 constant. So from this we can deduce that the number 7 was actually carried down to the Talmudic scan an accurate record of the fact that it must be 7. Okay, and you must remember that the scholars from the time of Moses kept written records of the oral law as well. They just were not published. They were not permitted to be published. But they, for themselves privately, they always kept written records. Okay, the reason why they didn't allow it to be publicized is simply because of the fact that that is a law that you're not allowed to write down the oral law and have it publicized at large. And the reason is, Maimonides explains, because then anyone that gets a hold of it will simply read one part of it and they'll think he understands it, they'll think he's a great theoretician, and they'll misinterpret it, which is what happens today all the time. Whenever I read these articles which quote Talmud, it's amazing how people have no concept of what the study of Talmud is, and as a natural result, they misinterpret it. So today, we can't do anything about it, but we have to live with it. But originally, the only ones that had access to the oral law were the ones who were the scholars, and they only permitted scholars to have access to it. Now, let's get back to the point then in the Talmud. So we see the number 7 is definitely something which was carried down from Sinai. Now, then we have to come back to our little piece of Talmud. According to our part of Talmud in the beginning, it states that there were 7, and then with these other opinions that say even blood, okay, even the castration of animals, and then we have sorcery, okay. So how can we have? And then we also have the prohibition against the crossbreeding, okay. And how is that possible? So let us take a look at each one separately. All right, there is one. One answer we can give when we take a look at the first one. I think everyone will probably think of this answer. Let's take a look at each one individually. The first one is that Rabbi Chanan stated even on blood, okay, blood from the living. Now, there we could simply say that Rabbi Hananya is not adding something new to the 7. He is simply saying that is included in the violation of removing a limb from an animal and consuming it. In other words, what he is saying is he's not adding number 8. He's saying that with regard to what you mentioned before, in other words, with regard to the prohibition of taking a limb from an animal and consuming it, that doesn't just include the limb, but it includes blood also. Whereas the first position maintained, no, it does not include blood. It only includes the flesh of the limb. Okay? So here we don't encounter the problem with the number, because we've established from the further part, from the text a little further, that they did consider, that the Talmudic scholars did have number seven. If they had number seven, so the question was, how could you add number eight? And the answer is, it's not an addition. Rabbi Hananya is not adding anything. He is simply saying, I want to make this point clear, I disagree with the previous statement, which only mentions the flesh of the animal. I say the blood is also included. Okay? So now what we have to do is, we have an argument, a Talmudic dispute. And we have to see, what are the theoretics behind the dispute? We're going to take them, as I said before, we're going to take them one at a time. So let's forget about the ones that come later. Let's just deal with this one, with the blood of the living animal, blood taken from the living animal. Okay, so now how do we approach this? We have an argument among the scholars. One scholar says that the blood is permissible. If you take the animal during its lifetime, and you should remove a pint of blood, then you could drink it. The other states, no. This is a prohibition which is included in the under the law under the violation of consuming the limb of an animal. Now, how do we begin to approach this? I mean, we could just start with some with speculation, but that's not the the proper way. The way we have to approach this is, we have to see what other information is contained in the oral law. You have to realize that every scholar in the Talmud, when he discusses one area, knew the entire Talmud. Okay? They're at a very great advantage over us, because we are studying this portion of the Talmud, but we don't know the whole Talmud. Okay? But everyone who was a scholar knew every Mishnah and all the interpretations on their fingertips. So here they're discussing this little portion, but meantime their theories are coming from the vast knowledge that they have. Okay, so what we have to do is do a little investigation with regard to halachic investigation with regard to this area of the blood of the animal, and we could start off with a logical question. The logical question is, would you say that the blood of the animal should be included under this prohibition or not? What would you say about that? Now, it's not enough just to say what you would say, yes or no, but you have to also be able to support it with some kind of a theory. Now, on the surface, I would think that most people would say, well, yes, because what's the difference between the blood and between the flesh? This is all part of the animal. Okay. Now, then, if that's the case, if that is true, then the conclusion is correct. But what we have to do is, we have to seek through our Talmudic sources to see if that conclusion is correct. Okay? So what do? So we go to the area of the Torah that deals with the prohibition of blood, and we raise a question. Is the prohibition of blood a separate prohibition, or is blood prohibited because it's a part, a component of the animal itself? It is the animal. Okay? Now, of course, you'll ask me the question, well, how am I going to discover this? Because since the Torah prohibited blood, here, in order to understand the seven laws of Noah, we have to go to the laws, to the 613, because the concepts are always going to be consistent. You're not going to have different concepts.
Rabbi, okay. We've got to turn the tape.